Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Plumbing Game Studies, a games and philosophy podcast. I'm your host, Graham Culbertson, and I wanted to remind you that this comes from the Critical Game Studies Initiative of the English and Comparative Literature Department at UNC Chapel Hill. I know that's a mouthful, but I want you to know where I'm podcasting from, because I want us to be a node here in the international nexus of game studies. This is another little episode from me on games and philosophy. I'm calling them mini games. In between the interviews that I'm lining up on important philosophical works for game studies, today I want to talk about anxiety and the work of Arthur Schopenhauer, which gets at the point of games and play, and I'll relate it a bit to the work of Bernard Suits, The Grasshopper. I honestly think this is the beginning of an ongoing series of mini games, because I was writing this, I came up with four or five more ideas that are connected. I'll just see where it goes. So this episode dealing with Schopenhauer was suggested by a little throwaway line by Suits in The Grasshopper. You've already heard several mentions of The Grasshopper on this show, and it really is an absolute work of art. If I taught young philosophers, I would teach it to all of them for an example of how to write. And honestly, it deserves to be taught as a work of literature. And although I fundamentally disagree with a lot of his conclusions, Suits' Grasshopper is an incredibly productive work. It was, for example, the starting point for Teen Wynn's Games Agency as Art, which, as you know, is a work that is near and dear to my heart. I'm hoping to have T back on the show soon to talk about The Grasshopper, so I look forward to that. So although I think The Grasshopper is wrong about games, I think it's really right as a theory of life. But although it's right as a theory of life, it's wrong about games because it's so anti-Wittgenstein. As Ione Arjoranta explained, it's really against a theory of Wittgenstein that is a misreading of Wittgenstein. And that book was published originally without the three appendices it has now, and essentially all three of them are attacks on Wittgenstein. And in the third appendix, which is called Words on Play, Suits references, quote, "the much quoted and much neglected observation of Schopenhauer that the play of animals consists in the discharge of superfluous energy." Now, maybe when Suits wrote The Grasshopper in the 1970s, this line was much quoted. Googling around, I have not actually been able to find that specific line. And I must admit, I know very little about Schopenhauer. I used to know absolutely nothing about Schopenhauer. In writing this episode, I've learned a little. Because when I went looking for this quote about the play of animals and their excess energy, I found Schopenhauer's essay, The Wisdom of Life. And The Wisdom of Life has some very interesting things to say about play, energy, and anxiety. So the first thing to know about The Wisdom of Life is that although it is one of Schopenhauer's most popular works, it's actually fundamentally anti-Schopenhauerian. Schopenhauer was a pessimist. That's how he describes himself, who essentially thought that life could not be lived happily. There was no hope for pleasure. He was deeply influenced by Buddhism, and for him, life was suffering. And suffering was caused by the will, the human will, wanting things and wanting to do things out in the world. So the ideal existence for Schopenhauer was an ascetic one, similar to the asceticism in Buddhism and Hinduism, in which the individual denies oneself the search for pleasure out in the world, doesn't try to get happiness from doing things in the world, but just sort of retreats back into the self. So the will, which is the key concept for Schopenhauer, can try to do things and find happiness in the world, but it will always fail. So Schopenhauer's pessimistic message was, don't try to be happy. Will yourself to not care about happiness, and this willful desire to not desire things is success. Schopenhauer was an enormous influence on Nietzsche, but Nietzsche changed his mind about Schopenhauer and decided that the only thing that mattered was the will struggling against the world, even though it was destined to fail. So Nietzsche is very similar to Schopenhauer, and in fact, the opposite of Schopenhauer. But The Wisdom of Life, despite being written by Schopenhauer, is also the opposite of Schopenhauer, because he says that the point of the wisdom in life is to teach us, quote, how to obtain the greatest amount of pleasure and success. Even though, he says, and here's another quote, the quest for a happy existence is based upon a fundamental mistake. So what Schopenhauer thinks is that you should not try to be happy. You should just give up and become a monk. But if you're going to seek happiness, Schopenhauer says, I guess this is how you would do it. Thanks, Schopenhauer. You are too kind. Very early on, Schopenhauer identifies the most important thing for happiness as health. And health requires activity. To be healthy, you must be doing things. Here's a long quote, slightly edited down, from The Wisdom of Life. All the processes of life demand exercise for the due performance of their functions. Exercise not only of the parts more immediately concerned, but also of the whole body. For as Aristotle rightly says, life is movement. It is its very essence. Ceaseless and rapid motion goes on in every part of the organism. When people can get no exercise at all, as is the case with the countless numbers who are condemned to a sedentary life, there is a glaring and fatal disproportion between outward inactivity and inner tumult. For this ceaseless internal motion requires some external counterpart, and the want of it produces effects like those of emotion, which we are obliged to suppress. All right, that's the end of the quote. So life itself, then, is motion. To be alive is to be moving, internally moving. And there is, therefore, excess energy produced internally. Our bodies are moving inside, so there is bubbling up inside of us the need to move. So to be healthy, you have to move your external body to release the energy from your internal body. But the upper class has a problem, according to Schopenhauer. If you are rich and you don't need to work, you don't need to move. You can just sit around. Or, to make this much more relevant to the 21st century, if you're in that middle and upper middle class called knowledge workers, maybe you do need to work, but what you call work is just sitting around behind a desk fiddling with Excel or PowerPoint or Google Docs. So you are not moving. And Schopenhauer says that if you are not being active, physically and mentally active, then your body, quote, produces effects like those of emotion, which we are obliged to suppress. So keep in mind, this isn't an emotion that you're feeling. It just feels like an emotion. Your excess energy has to go somewhere, and your body turns it into this bad emotional feeling. Even though it doesn't have an emotional origin, it actually has a physical origin that turns into an emotional effect. So when I read this bit of Schopenhauer, I was struck to its similarity to the flight or fight theory of anxiety. Here's a perfectly condensed version of that theory offered by Sadaf Farooqi on the podcast In Our Time. She says, the system turbocharges you to run away from a scary signal by releasing adrenaline. It makes your heart beat faster, your blood pressure, you breathe more quickly. So we have a very strong setup to deal with fight or flight. Of course, what happens in the real world now is quite challenging because commonly people will trigger that response for things which may not be quite so threatening. It may be perfectly reasonable to have that response if you're being threatened by an intruder. But getting that response because you're angry in a traffic jam is probably not necessary. But invariably, it's a physiological response to getting angry in a traffic jam. And what happens is if we trigger that response relatively easily with a situation that's not that threatening, that's when we perceive anxiety. If you're sitting in a traffic jam or you're stressed at home because of the family situation, then you perceive that as anxiety. All right, that's the end of the quote, and I take this to be just what Schopenhauer is saying. It's not an emotional response. It's physical things running in our body. And although they're whirring around in our body, if we don't do anything about them, we don't run or fight, they become emotions, even though they don't originate as emotions. They are, to go back to that Schopenhauer quote, effects like those of emotion, which we are obliged to suppress. So if you're willing to agree with me that what we currently call anxiety and what Schopenhauer called excess internal energy are the same thing, then there are two obvious ways to respond. The first one is to tamp the system down, reduce the internal energy. This is what sitting zazen, Zen meditation, does. It's also what yoga and tai chi do, although of course there's some physical activity in yoga and tai chi, but it is not triggering the hormone system. You can also do this with medication. Tranquilizers like Xanax and Valium directly reduce the internal energy of your nervous system. Alcohol does that as well. And SSRIs are designed to do the same thing, although they do it in a very roundabout way, and people are still arguing about how well they work at this calming. Calm everything down, cool the system off, reduce the excess energy. Chill, relax. You don't try to suppress that emotion, which is dangerous and stressful and is going to make you feel terrible. You prevent the emotion from bubbling up in the first place by reducing the excess energy in the system. And I think in his pessimistic mode, this is what Schopenhauer would tell us to do. But in this essay, he's willing to pretend that there are positive solutions. And he says, don't just sit there, move, do something. Or, to quote Schopenhauer, the truth which I am insisting upon here, the truth, namely, that the chief source of human happiness is internal, is confirmed by that most accurate observation of Aristotle in the Nicomachean Ethics. That every pleasure presupposes some sort of activity, the application of some sort of power, without which it cannot exist. The doctrine of Aristotle's, that a man's happiness consists in the free exercise of his highest faculties, is also enunciated by Stobaeus in his exposition of the Peripatetic philosophy. Happiness, he says, means vigorous and successful activity in all your undertakings, and he explains that by vigor, Greek arete, he means mastery in anything, whatever it be. That's the end of the quote. So if you want to be happy, you must be internally in balance. Happiness comes from inside of you. But since your internal movements are perpetually producing an excess of energy, you must be doing something, exercising your faculties to keep your internal systems in balance. And here, you must be exercising your faculties to be happy. This is Aristotle. He says it must be your highest faculties, but we'll leave that aside for now. And there must be, according to Stobaeus, vigor and mastery. It's no wonder that we get this from peripatetic philosophers, which just means that you do philosophy when you're walking around. This is a mind-body combined theory of happiness. And the Greek conception of philosophy was not about the mind. It was about the mind and body in balance. There's lots more to say about that when we start talking about games and philosophy. Athletics was a crucial part of Greek education and philosophy. That's why what we call high school in America is called gymnasium, the same word as gymnasium in Germany. Gym can mean the place where you learn the highest things and the place where you do sports, because for the Greeks, those weren't so different. But that's for future episodes. The really important thing for my conception of games, following on from Suits, is that this mastery or vigor is, quote, mastery in anything, whatever it be. Whatever it be, that means it can be a useless pursuit, a pursuit that has no value except in and of itself. And a useless pursuit is, in fact, Bernard Suits's definition of a game. Playing a game is the voluntary attempt to overcome unnecessary obstacles. There's no reason to try to put the ball in the hoop except for the desire to do something that gets you moving and doing something, even though it is, by its very nature, unnecessary. And Schopenhauer spends a few paragraphs talking about how games, totally useless games, satisfy this need for external activity, which will prevent our internal systems from revving up into anxiety. Here's a quote. One may say generally that if a man finds himself with nothing to do, he is sure to choose some amusement suited to the kind of power in which he excels. Bowls, it may be, or chess, hunting or painting, horse racing or music, cards or poetry, heraldry, philosophy, or some other dilettante interest. All right, that's the end of the quote, and bowls is roughly the same thing as bocce ball. So we have from Schopenhauer a theory of games which I see as closely resembling the one that comes from Suits. I also hear echoes in this idea that we choose amusements suited to the kind of power in which we excel, when Tien Nguyen writes in his book Games about what he calls the harmony of capacity, quote, "the experience of harmony between one's overall capacities and the demands of the practical environment," which it can be hard to find outside of games, but within games, you know, when you play that ace of spades to trump someone, or you finally get to build the longest road of Settlers in Catan, or you smash that Goomba who was taunting you. This is the harmony of capacities. They give us a chance to exert this mastery in an otherwise meaningless activity. Aristotle, I think, really wants us only to exert mastery in things that really matter for human flourishing. But Schopenhauer's pessimism, since he doesn't think we can really master the world anyway, makes him happy to endorse meaningless pursuits. It's a limited endorsement, but nevertheless an endorsement. Even though he says in various places that intellectual pursuits are superior to physical pursuits, he only means that because they'll make you happier. He doesn't want to do an Aristotelian thing about the good life because he doesn't think an Aristotelian good life is really possible. So if it doesn't matter, if there's no victory in this world, if the will can never actually win when it steps in and tries, well, why not just play a fun game where there is some winning? I think Schopenhauer would probably be horrified by this use of his pessimism, but I also think it's right there in the text. Humans have to do something, and they can never beat the universe. In his other texts, Schopenhauer argues that you should pull back from the universe. But you could also just play Ticket to Ride of The Legend of Zelda, places where you can win, or even if you don't win, you have the pleasure of playing a game, and you have the freedom of knowing that play is as good as anything else. Why not? It'll make you happy. And the fact that you're exercising these faculties and doing stuff with the energy that's welling up from inside you means that you will not suffer from anxiety. All right, so that's as far as I wanted to go with Schopenhauer. Just a couple of last things that are going to set up some future episodes. And these things come from Schopenhauer's list of these activities you can do to be happy. Bowls, aka bocce, chess, hunting, painting, horse racing, music, cards, poetry, heraldry, philosophy, or some other dilettante interest. First, this list is just funny, especially since it includes philosophy as a pointless activity. There's some pessimism for you. Secondly, if you're simply trying to be happy, all that matters is that you engage your body and mind. And some of these things are tabletop games, like chess or cards, that I guess wouldn't really engage the body. Some are physical games, like bocce or horse racing, that engage the body more than mind. Some are associated with gambling. Some are not games at all. They're forms of art, like poetry, painting, or music. And some of them, like heraldry. Heraldry isn't art or a game. It's simply leisure, a way of killing time. So this list is setting up the Wittgensteinian work that I'm going to try to do in some future episodes. First, I want to sort out some various category of games, especially as games are related to these other categories, like leisure. I've noticed that games people really dislike games being lumped in with leisure more broadly. Here's a great quote on that from the scholar and poet A.E. Hausman, who is quoted by Mary Midgley in her essay, The Game Game. Hausman is criticizing a fellow scholar, who he's calling X, who is doing work called conjectural emendation. Here's the Hausman quote. "Conjectural emendation, as practiced by X, is not a game, an exercise requiring skill and heed, like marbles, or skittles, or cat's cradle, but a pastime, like leaning against a wall and spitting." So that's the end of the quote. Skittles is another form of lawn bowling, by the way, and I find this quite funny because even something so trivial as marbles requires skill and heed. But leisure activities, like spitting, require no skill at all. So games, then, for Hausman, are wastes of time that nevertheless require mastery and skill. Leisure doesn't, according to Hausman, And of course, there are many more related concepts. I'm going to try to use Suits and Nguyen and Midgley to give you my own definition of games and how they are related to play, sports, pastimes, and athletics, as well as probably a few more. I also want to use John Dewey, Stanislaw Lem, and again, Mary Midgley and T. Nguyen to talk about the relationship between games and art. And I definitely want to talk more about game stress and anxiety. I'm sure, among other people, I will use the philosopher Byung-Chul Han there. So you can look forward to all of those, as well as upcoming episodes on Kawa, Hausinger, Suits, and other fun things like the work of David Graeber. Email me questions, comments, and episode ideas at graham.culbertson@unc.edu. And remember, the unexamined game is not worth playing.